The following program contains scenes and language of a frank and explicit nature. Viewer discretion is advised.
Here, so please, nobody be themselves.
I know. Don't serve garlic. Don't stab your guest in the heart with a wooden stake. Don't ask him if he knows Frankenstein. It's racist somehow.
We are here now for our second annual Halloween roundtable discussion. We've sat down with some beer and some Dr. Pepper and some Doritos. So you're likely to notice that things sound a little bit different than our usual episodes. It's because we're slowly trying to drink our way into accepting John. We're already off to a bad start. We have with us here today Jason Santo and Larry Clow, who did join us last year for our discussion of Rob Zombie's Halloween. Gentlemen, do you want to go ahead and say hello?
I'm Larry Clow. I'm a freelance writer and film critic for The Wire newspaper here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which you can find online at wirenh.com. I'm also the co-founder of Sub Rosa Drive-In Guerrilla Theater, which also takes place here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire every summer.
And I'm Jason Santo. I'm a former filmmaker and movie buff and aficionado of the worst types of cinema that one can possibly imagine. And I'm here to talk some serious Twilight right now.
I think the best way to kick off this episode, let's all just kind of come clean right up front.
Yep.
How many of us, what's the count on these movies? Did you watch all three? Did you watch one, two? What did we all actually manage?
I want to know format, too. I want to know how you watched it.
Let's start with Clown.
I will say that I've seen Twilight, the first movie, twice. I saw it in theaters when it came out a couple years ago. I wrote a review of it then for The Wire. That's wirenh.com. And I watched it for a second time for this roundtable on DVD. And I briefly entertained the notion of watching the other movies in the series so that I could provide a full and complete informed opinion for this episode. But after suffering through the first movie, I decided that I just could not watch the other two. And so I didn't.
So there you have it.
John, you didn't get sidetracked by Josie and the Pussycats on TNT or anything?
No, I saw the first movie a while back on DVD with my then roommate, and then I've seen the other two in theaters.
What?
Really?
Wow. Yep.
I saw the second one actually at a pre-release screening before the midnight showing. I spend about 30% of my income at Best Buy. So I got an offer for a special
membership.
Yep. Ding. A 9 o'clock viewing the day before it came out. So when all the little Twilight kids were in line waiting for the midnight viewing,
you were the creepy adult standing there with the rest of them.
Well, I have a friend who's very much my imaginary friend Jess Cogswell is very into the Twilight series, and so I took her because I figured she'd get a kick out of that.
Okay. You have an alibi.
So you've seen all three?
I've seen all three.
Two in the theater.
Two
that
in
you
the theater.
Paid for.
Yep.
I think you should go because I'm going to save mine.
Oh, I have seen all three. I watched the first one with my wife because she tolerates a lot of stupidity on behalf of Film Jitsu. A lot. She is incredibly understanding of what Film Jitsu does to my social agenda. So she wanted to watch Twilight, and so I sat down and I watched it with her, complaining as minimally as possible about the experience. And then I quickly got copies of the other two for this podcast, and so I have powered through them, although I have to be honest, that last one, I kind of wasn't paying a lot of attention. I was doing my top five list while it was playing, so I didn't really absorb that final one.
Well, I have seen all of three movies twice now. I saw Twilight first on DVD, and then again a couple days ago on Blu-ray. And then,
does it sparkle all that much more?
Saw New Moon on DVD, and then on Blu-ray. Saw Eclipse in the. No, I'm sorry. Wait, I got it backwards. Wait, which one's third? Eclipse is third, right? That's the third one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The names are so damn similar.
I don't know. All right,
Eclipse is the third one, I think, and I saw that one in the theater and on Blu-ray. So we now own all three on Blu-ray.
So I would say of the four of us, Jason's commitment to Sparkle Motion is the most serious.
Yeah.
Now, serious commitment.
Did you already pre-order your ticket for Breaking Wind or whatever that last installment is?
You've been waiting.
You've been hanging on to that joke.
You've been saving that joke.
You've been saving that one up.
The real joke is that Carmichael has a VIP pass to the like Thursday week prior, you know, 1 p.m. show.
He's going to be the only guy camping out in front of the theater. Yeah.
I'm going to say in my defense that my wife is an enormous Twilight fan, loves the books, has read them all, loves the movies, and so that's going to be my defense for why they're all on Blu-ray and why I've seen them all in HD.
Has anybody ever read a Twilight book?
No. That would be
unbelievable.
No,
I would
know. But I know pretty much everything that happens during the Breaking Dawn.
Okay. So. You're very caught up. That's
I don't
good.
Actually need to,
that's good.
To read it.
I was given a copy of the first one for Christmas by a friend who thought it would convince me to read it if I was actually given a copy.
You need to find new friends.
Yeah, I read about the first page. Just, you know, I was like, all right, I'm going to crack this open and just see it. And by page two, I wanted to punch the Bella character in the face.
Yeah, well... Well, it's much like watching the first movie.
We might as well just dive right into the films then. Where to start? I guess we could start with Bella. In a word.
Oh my God.
Boring for me. I don't understand at all what it is about this character that is in any way compelling to a point that it drives this whole franchise. Mm-hmm. Is this vampire and this girl that he's completely over the moon about. Pardon the bad phrase, I guess. But, he falls in love with her instantly, and she is just plain as anything. Like, I couldn't even fall in interest with this character. Never mind in love.
Hmm. Well, if you're looking for an explanation as to why the audience likes her so much, I mean, the target audience here, you know, is teen girls. And, yeah. And because Bella is so uninteresting, she's a blank slate, sort of. And so I think in terms of the audience, it's very easy for the audience to just be like, oh, Bella is just like me, because the character of Bella is so generic that you can, you know, put whatever you want into that character. Just be like, oh, Bella is, she's interested in the same things I am, which, I mean, she isn't, because she's not interested in anything, because she's not interesting. But you read it that way.
And that's, she exists only to be a conduit for the feelings and confused emotions and worries about the futures of teenage girls, or even youthful lust or youthful love or all those new emotions and everything else that informs the character more than anything the character does by itself. So I think that that's the big thing there. I think Larry hit the nail on the head. She is, however, I would say not so much as boring as annoying. I find her impossibly annoying.
Is that Kristen Stewart? Is it Kristen
Stewart?
No,
it's actually
annoying?
The character based on what Sherry tells. My wife is Sherry. She'll play a major role in this podcast. from what I hear, you know, Bella is translated pretty literally right off the page into the movie. And I think that Kristen Stewart was well chosen to play that. Now, yeah, I mean, it could be that she's an annoying person. I guess in interviews she is kind of soap on a rope or whatever, but
her acting style drives me up a wall.
Yeah,
it gets arduous over the, you know, if you do that kind of marathon that I did over the past 2 days, like a 7 hours or so straight Twilight viewing. You know,
did you play the Kristen Stewart hair drinking game where she brushes the hair from like her face?
I actually
noticed that
in moments of pensiveness.
I would say it was more that she haltingly starts a sentence would be my drinking game, because you'd be shit-faced by the 14th minute of the first movie.
I actually did try and keep count during the first movie. I kept a tally of the Kristen Stewart hair maneuver. I lost count after 12 times and just didn't bother to try and pick it up after then.
I must be uniquely unobservant at this point in my life, because I didn't even notice that. It was all the... That.
Once you notice it, you'll never see anything else.
Yes.
I have the Kristen Stewart School of Acting right here. It starts with, in any interaction, a character says something to her, and she reacts the same way every time. It starts with excessive blinking, and then slowly biting your lower lip, just a little bit. Then you kind of sigh heavily and grimace your face like you're slightly conflicted. You look sheepishly down at the floor, like you're simultaneously sad and thinking really hard. Then you move your hair either out of your face or into your face,
depending on
the situation. Yeah. And that's it. You repeat for the next sentence.
This also sounds like a neurological condition.
I mean, yes, it could be.
It could be.
Followed by shaking, cold sweats.
Mm-hmm.
Hallucinations.
It's like she's on some sort of allergy medication. Yeah. This is what you list at the bottom of the ad.
Side effects may include.
Result in Kristen Stewart acting method. I think that the thing that is most... I'm doing Kristen Stewart right now, in case you didn't pick up on it.
You do look a bit sad.
Oh, yeah. Man. It's just so funny. You really do nail it. That's exactly how she acts. But I think that she was perfect for the role. I mean, I just...
Well...
You can't... cast better, because in a lot of ways I think a lot of girls are like, and I think that the target audience really is young girls. I mean, it's
sure.
Yeah. I don't want to marginalize the appeal to the movie to older women or whatever else, but I mean, really,
right?
The target audience is that, and it's so easy to put yourself in place of Bella. I think
sure,
if you're in that,
right?
You know what I mean?
And I think this is something that kept coming up in my notes, and Jason, you mentioned it just sure. a couple minutes ago, is that. A lot of the problems with the Twilight movies are, I mean, there are technical problems with the acting and the directing and all of that, but a lot of the problem is that the source material sucks. The characters are bad, and no matter, you know, there's only so much you can do to bring that to the screen. And so if the character of Bella is awful or uninteresting and bland, we can blame Kristen Stewart for it a little bit, but we also really need to blame the script, and then we need to blame the source material for it. You can't, like, separate them.
But we all just admitted a short time ago that none of us have read Stephanie Meyer's book. So I'm completely uninformed on the actual source material.
Yeah, but the decisions that are made to make this film are all based on that source material.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of whether we're informed on what goes on the page, the decisions made for this film, and they're widely well-respected by the readers. Like, they're very little, there's very little reader revolt, you know, between what was written on the page and what is presented on screen. Mm-hmm. People are pretty satisfied.
Yeah.
Which is remarkably, it's remarkably rare for a something that's this big of a thing.
It's a huge, it's
you know, I mean,
phenomenal.
even within the Harry Potter camp, which I think most people like those movies, a lot of people who were very into the books had some problems with the movies. I think they were willing to forgive a little bit more because the movies weren't that bad. They are actually separate from the books. The movies were good movies,
mm-hmm.
and people were able to forgive a little bit, even though they did have some issues with it. You know, it sounds to me, and I obviously I'm not like reading, you know, Twilight reviews and you know, fanfic or anything like that, but it sounds to me like
that was denial.
I'm not definitely reading not reading the fanfiction.
But I think you're right. There, that seems
team
to be
Jacob, team Edward, team both.
Oh my god.
Oh god.
Oh, finger cups.
Oh Jesus.
Oh,
it seems to be.
Oh, it's a cold. Oh, it's a warm.
Oh god. Dear Christ, that took a turn. But it seems to me like it is a very literal translation.
That would have solved a lot of issues in this movie, wouldn't it?
I actually, in kind of thinking about
the
this,
thunderstorms.
The icy hot maneuver.
Give it up.
We got our first round table high five. Way to go. Yeah, I actually saw from a couple of different places when I was researching this film, people were like, you know, if Edward and Jason,
wow.
if
I would bang Kristen Stewart.
If Edward and Jacob just got together, it would solve a lot of problems with the stupidity of this film, which is kind of true.
I have not read any of the books, but like Jason, my girlfriend Carrie at least read the first book. And when I reported back to her the events of the movie in detail, she said, oh, that sounds exactly like it was in the book. The translation is pretty literal. And so,
and let's be honest, that's because nothing really happens.
But what's really difficult, well,
yes,
there are three things that happen.
All right,
in that
guys,
whole movie.
I think we need to pull back a little bit here because, I mean, you pretty much say, Larry, straight up in your assessment of this, that the source material is the problem, which I agree. I think that if it is even a problem, though, see, I don't think that the story is all that bad. And I don't think that the treatment of vampires really is so sacrilegious. I feel as though it's just alternate takes. Then there's a lot of things I don't like about it. There's a lot. But I don't think that it's as egregiously awful.
I think my problem, and I can't really fault the film itself or even Stephanie Myers. It's sort of a product of the phenomenon. What really bothers me is that the mythology, the vampire mythology of these stories has sort of informed an entire generation about what vampires are. And in my mind, I'm like, but they got it wrong. No. Like,
heading there for a while. I mean, if you look at the evolution of vampires in mythology, I mean, going back to Mesopotamia, and I'm not going to turn this into a history lesson, but if you look at it in film.
I think it's pretty awesome that you just went there.
I'm
digging it right now.
But if you look at them even in film, if you go back to 22, Murnau's Nosferatu, that's not a sexy vampire by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I mean,
that didn't happen until the Hammer movies.
I don't mean that every vampire has to be sexy with a billowy shirt and bedroom eyes.
But that's what I'm saying. We're evolving towards that.
But they sparkle.
But that's the thing, is we're evolving towards that. If you watch the way they've gone, and Stoker's myth really is the one that set this up, if you look at the way they've become that symbol for confliction between the good and the evil, the sexual desires. I mean, it's a very Catholic kind of thing.
It is
this
wicked.
Whole sex is evil,
well,
so it has to be
by the Catholics to keep people in line.
There's always been sort of, you know, the demon that drinks your blood or whatever. But
please send your faith-based emails to Mike and John at filmmaking.com.
But if you look at that, that sort of like inhibition that comes from, you know, the need to conceal your animal instincts and your lust and all that shit. I mean, this was a vehicle for people to feel that, and we've been edging in that direction ever since. And I did use that, you know, that was a pun on purpose. We've been heading in that direction ever since, so that you start to see, and if you go to something like it, Anne Rice takes it a step further, and now you get the conflicted vampire, I don't want to be a vampire, I really want to be a good person. So we've been evolving in this direction. Anyway, I don't necessarily like the leap that was made to the sparkle motion, but at the same time, it makes sense in the timeline. We've been heading in this direction.
Can I step quickly in defense of sparkle motion?
This because, I can't wait to hear.
No, I just, okay, I think Catherine Hardwicke is a horrible director. I think she did a terrible job with a lot of the direction, a lot of the choices made in the movie. Where I don't think she made a bad choice was in casting, and I think there were some great decisions there. But when it came to Stephanie Meyer in the writing of the vampire and the fact that they're literally ice, you know what I mean? That there's a lot of parallels between them being frozen in time, you know, frozen in that stage of life, that they're not just cold, but like really cold.
I heard them like described as marble in a couple of different places. Yeah. Like their skin has a marble quality.
I don't think that they sparkle so much as, and this may be, like, it's hard for me to blame Stephanie Meyer for this, but I think what she more so may have meant was that much like ice in front of the sun, they shimmer a little bit and shine a little bit. And then the translation to film, I think it was very silly.
Yeah.
Especially because of the included sound effect that happened in the first two movies, but didn't happen in the third movie. And in fact, the third movie pulled off the effect a little bit better and almost had that iciness feel to it. So I was like, okay.
The first two was very gay club.
Oh, it was very, very.
it was glitter everywhere.
And it was silly.
Yeah,
it was.
And in the first movie, which is the only one I saw, but that is the point where the movie like completely falls apart for me.
Yeah.
And Catherine Hardwicke is not a great director, but for Twilight, I thought this was perfectly acceptable as like a teen thriller, maybe like a made-for-MTV sort of movie. And for the first 30 minutes, I bought it. I was okay with it. And then when we come to the first reveal where Bella manages to piece together that Edward is a vampire, and she, you know, they go for their walk in the woods. And Edward is like, yes, I'm totally a vampire. And then he says, but first I must show you this. And he like opens his shirt Superman style and stands in a shaft of sunlight. Mm-hmm. And he's like, this is the skin of a killer. The movie came to a screeching halt for me. And I was like, really? Like that glittery chest hair is the skin of a killer?
There are huge issues with the presentation. I'm not sure where it originates because we all keep saying.
I think it originates in the source material. I don't think there's any. I think you could have given that.
And saying that this is the skin of the killer is ridiculous. But that's something that runs throughout, and that's a major problem with the presentation of these vampires in general, is that they're never presented as killers.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there's never really truly a downside to being a vampire in this story.
No, you hear about the potential.
You hear about,
but you never see it in action.
You do see a couple glimpses
of them kind of losing control.
Right. Well, that's among the Cullens. You actually do see some pretty rough stuff going on with other vampires. But I think the fact that they just refer to themselves as monsters doesn't make the decision to become one of them all that
weird.
And I think that one of the biggest problems of this story was that, you know, Bella's never really face to face with what their true nature is. In fact, when they hunt and kill animals or anything like that, Bella never sees any of that. So she never really gets the dark side.
Look, that's one of those areas I'm not willing to compromise about changing vampire mythology. Calling vampires that eat animals vegetarians is so fucking ball stupid.
I don't think it's stupid.
The concept is fine, but when they're like, we're vegetarians, I wanted to reach in and punch somebody in the face for saying it.
I don't know.
Oh, it just drove me up a fucking wall.
I think that there were a lot of things that I think Stephanie Meyer thought were clever that weren't, and then there were things that she did that were well. And I think that went well. And she's clever in a number of ways and extremely not clever. The one not clever thing that I think stands out more than anything is we moved to Washington. Well, it's near Seattle, but Forks, Washington, because it's always cloudy.
That was another thing that irritated me is not only in like kind of developing a new mythology for vampires, but you took the one thing that would be like, this fucks vampires up. Couldn't we all agree on that at least? And you're like, nope. Now, not only is it not a problem, it makes them kind of pretty.
Let me just say this: if I were Bella Swan and I had to make an informed decision about whether or not to become a vampire based on these movies, as the Collins presented, there are no downsides.
Exactly.
Like John was saying, there's always throughout history and throughout hundreds of years of movies, vampires are always portrayed at their core as a tragic figure.
Yeah.
They're separated from humans, and even if they want to like love a human or take part in human society because they once were human, they can't. And that's the tragedy of it. Like, they can't do it. But if you're a Cullen, you get to hang out in your sweet Frank Lloyd Wright-esque house in Washington.
You're the cool aloof kid at high school.
You have a garage full of awesome sports cars. You always look like you're ready for an Abercrombie photo shoot. You can walk around in the daylight. You can climb up trees super fast. You can fly. You get to play vampire baseball. You have a family.
That's the trick. And I think you referred to the family thing. And I think that's the thing that makes this story different from some of the others, is that there is this core
tribe.
I don't really want to call them a tribe, because I think family is really the accurate thing to say. They bind together because they're eternal, and that if they were to keep forging bonds with mortals, they would keep, the biggest hurt of being a vampire is seeing everyone that you love pass away.
Right.
And unfortunately, it's the only true downside to these vampires, is that they live on and on and on, and they're going to see people pass away. You know, there's a lot of talk about them being monsters and all that stuff.
But they never earn that. And they try to pass Edward off as a tragic figure, but they never earn it.
They don't, especially because he's only 100 years old. He really hasn't lost all that much. He hasn't, you know what I mean? So it's
Am I the only one bothered by the fact that he's 100 years old chasing a high school student?
No.
This film is rife with pedophilia.
No, that's not rife with pedophilia. He's eternally 17 years old. He's going into.
I disagree. He's presented like the wise figure. You saw the matriculation caps, right?
You saw all the different times that he's graduated high school, all the different times that he's gone through this. That doesn't mean every time he's been picking up and going with girls. He went with this girl because of something called fate, and I think that plays a huge part in this story. And whether you decide to believe in fate, the fate of Bella, or you decide not to, is whether or not you really understand, but really care what happens to her. Fate is the bigger issue in this story. And I think that her and Edward were fated to be together, and that he doesn't just, it's not pedophilia because he's...
I don't mean it's literally pedophilia, but there are some things here. I mean, there's this father vampire that's like 15 minutes older than everybody else. And he seems only interested in turning good-looking teenagers into the vampires that keeps around forever. Like, where is the Betty White of this universe?
I think there's a central conceit in the people that he's turned, and I think a lot of it has to do with those powers that they possess that are beyond just the agility and the speed and all that stuff, and the strength.
Yeah, there's like second sight and all kinds of different things.
Yeah, and I think that when you turn, one of the decisions and one of the things that factors into the Volturi really being interested in Bella is the fact that she's got this almost shield to vampire powers. Mm-hmm. that is very attractive to the Volturi. It's very attractive to turning her into a vampire. And I think that what happens with a lot of the people that are turned to vampires and that persist over hundreds of years or whatever else, they're kept alive because of their powers. So, yes, they just happen to be fucking gorgeous, which is retarded.
Yeah. Right. Whenever,
when do you not watch Hollywood Fair and where everybody's gorgeous and beautiful?
Right. Well, that's a larger issue. Sure. And certainly whenever there are shots of the Cullens walking around in Forks High School in the first movie, they look like they're in slow motion. They're always posing for a photo shoot.
They do. Yeah, it's retarded, and it's Hardwick. That's Hardwick.
And you know what else? I think it's over the top.
But that's
no,
that's Hardwick.
It didn't have to be. It's Hardwick by way of fucking Tarantino. It's that slow motion Michael Bay bullshit.
Right.
It's
the same.
Yeah. We don't need a Reservoir Dog shot.
Because she pulled that shit in Lords of Dogtown, too.
Or
fucking Armageddon when all the astronauts are walking in line.
But going back to what Mike said, I appreciate Jason's take on this, but I could not get over the creepy factor of Edward being, you know, he is 100 years old. He is eternally 17, but he has lived for 100 years.
He's not resetting to being 17.
And
who does he interact with?
And he acts...
Who does he interact with? He interacts with mostly his family.
Who are also super old.
Before Bella came to that school, he had almost no interaction with the rest of those kids there.
Right.
The Cullens, they're creepy, they're weird, they keep to themselves.
Yeah.
Of course all the girls are lusting after him because he's mysterious.
Yeah.
He's James fucking Dean. Look at his hair, he's got the sideburns.
Oh yeah, no, I know.
He's a rebel, he's sort of dark.
And also...
But he's not striking up relationships with people.
No, I know, but he's... But he is striking up a relationship with a 17-year-old girl in this movie.
This time because he can't help it.
All right.
Boy, doesn't that sound an awful lot like the pedophiles?
Right.
No,
hey, man,
and
I couldn't
bullshit.
Help myself.
No, and, no it also sounds like true love. I mean...
This movie has nothing to do with true love.
That's bullshit. I think
there
it does.
Is nothing, there
then you
is
don't
nothing
have a romantic
about
bone in your body.
The entire, I have many
the
romantic bones
myth.
In my body.
He's got one.
Oh, it's not a bone.
John, I think before somebody goes across the table here and tears somebody's throat out, why don't we go ahead and take ourselves a quick break with a little music by the Tan Vampires.
You will not understand where the hours and minutes went. You will learn to resent every clock in your house. You can hide away indoors, a secret carnivore. If you're frightened, it
I gotta say, this is the fundamental difference between the way we think about this. And for me, Twilight is like a how-to manual for creepy boyfriendism. It
like
is
watching her sleep for months.
Yeah,
but that's the threatening part of him. That's the dark side and the what.
But it's presented
part,
as like a
but
romantic.
She's totally cool with it, which. Is
well,
like,
she, I
is
don't
like
think
saying
she knew that he sat at the foot
is
of
like saying
which
your,
is creepier, yeah.
Right? And it's
he also
it's,
doesn't sleep,
right?
And it's tacitly saying to your audience of teen girls, "Hey, it's totally cool if you have a boyfriend who stalks you."
Well, this brings up another issue actually that I would
I
like to talk about because I really was bothered by the fact that in a lot of ways this Bella character to me seemed like a big feminist step backwards.
Completely.
She's helpless all the time.
Edward doesn't even let her drive. He never lets her drive.
Doesn't let her do it. She's completely helpless, and she feels like she needs to be validated as a human, as an existence, by the affection of this one man. It just didn't seem to me like there was... It wasn't a message that... I have a young daughter now, and I couldn't imagine wanting my daughter to grow up and read this character and identify with her. I would be devastated if my daughter identified with a character that was like so helpless and so in need of being protected by this man and his power. And I really don't think I'm reading too much into it. I really don't.
No, like, I think that's
it bothered me.
Yeah.
I don't know that I agree.
I think it depends on the take. There's definitely some Doubtfire syndrome here going on because if you take just his...
if you take a vampire and put
But if you take his actions, if you take his actions completely out of the context...
Right. He's an abusive boyfriend.
That's fucked up.
Right.
That is a fucked up person, and that is a really fucked up relationship. And in the context, that's I think that's what's happening is can you separate it from the context or not? You know,
mm-hmm. I think that John makes a perfect point on that. He's a... he's a vampire.
And that's the thing, is the vampire is always,
you know what he would traditionally do rather than watch her? He would go into a room and fucking drink her blood, whether she was 17 or 34 or whatever else. But he fights the urge to do that because he feels something strong inside of him, some sort of bond, some sort of something.
The vampire myth has always had
love. It's a real deal type of thing.
And I get what you're saying, but I couldn't get past the fact that it was a 17-year-old.
Anti-feminist. I just don't. This is what 17-year-olds go through. They go through mixed emotions and confused times with love. Men, women, everybody does. From 17 to 25, you're pretty much an emotional fuck show. You don't know what you're doing half the time. You don't know where you're going. You don't know whether she's thinking something about you or you're thinking something about her. And what are these signs? And are these things that I should act on or whatever else? Now, I'm not saying that Eric is... Eric, see, this is my true blood thing happening. Edward. I'm not saying that Edward is... you know, subject to those 17-year-old whims and,
sure,
and difficulties. But I am saying that she is, that Bella is. And sure, that was one of the more infuriating parts of this story for me, was because once you introduce Jacob into this story, then you have a supernatural being that's alive,
wow,
that offers all of these great opportunities and all of these really wonderful things that, about being alive. And he represents life and the chance at life.
Jacob.
Boom.
Jason, you just won the prize. We made it this far without talking about Jacob.
But it's incredible. You find that some, you do.
Yeah, yeah. But it's kind of amazing that it hasn't come up yet.
We're all focused on the first movie, and Jacob truly isn't
in the
first,
yeah,
in the first,
yeah,
movie. Right. He appears, but he's not really there.
Uh-huh.
But the real conflict and the real love and the real confusion and everything else that stems from here is comes once Jacob really enters the mix.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
And I think.
Well, I think.
I do think it's love, though.
Oh, okay. Well, now I have not seen the other movies, and so
right,
perhaps I'm missing something, but I feel in my heart that I'm not. but based on the first
There's
movie,
five books, you've seen one chapter of one book. I mean, it's tough for you to assess the whole thing.
Based
Just
on
based
this,
on the fact that she's a Mormon or whatever that you're
No. Based on this first movie, looking at the way Edward and Bella are written as characters, mm-hmm, and the interactions between the actors, between Edward Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart, I felt like there was no love between them. I felt like they
absolutely
were,
and
they
I
were,
agree.
They were both,
I
like,
agree.
There's
if you look
no
at the first
chemistry,
movie, and I blame Hartwick.
There's no, yep, chemistry. They
sucks.
Both seem slightly annoyed with each other.
Agreed.
And Hartwick has this annoying maneuver where there are these forced close-ups of them like together in their faces in quick succession that are trying to establish, yep, some chemistry that's
Couldn't
not really
more.
There.
You're absolutely right.
I'll tell you,
and
I
it drove me batty throughout the whole movie.
As it should.
Because I could never understand, like, you know, if this is some grand tale of eternal love,
yep,
and fate and
then
everything.
Then you failed miserably with your first chapter.
Yeah, like, right, the first chapter doesn't establish it.
I
and
agree.
maybe it's better in later movies.
Well, I think what happens is you're treated to, like any characters, you get more layers of the onion as you pull forward. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not just this one level, you know? They're not just archetypical. They become a little more diverse and a little more rich as you progress, and specifically those secondary characters do, which really flesh out the entire tale. And the decision between Jacob and Edward and stuff was never really a decision. She's always team Edward no matter what anybody says. It fixes a very poor first installment of this tale, and if Twilight were to stand on its own, then I would probably sit on your side of the table and say everything that you did about the story. And I would probably say, from a feminist perspective, that she is kind of a pathetic creature.
Mm-hmm.
But the larger, sort of almost, not altruistic isn't the right word, but the larger sacrifices that are made for love later on in later chapters in New Moon and in Eclipse. In New Moon, Edward actually goes away from Bella, stays
right.
away from her,
mm-hmm.
because he's a danger to her, number one. And number two, he knows that she wants to become eternal, to be with him, and he doesn't want that kind of existence for her. And so the biggest gesture that he can make in loving her is by leaving.
And what does
and
she do, though?
And subsequently, Jacob has to make those huge decisions, too.
Right.
He has to make these huge grand gestures of love, because in order to really show how much he loves Bella, he has to allow her to be with Eric. keep doing it, Edward.
Have fun editing that.
Yeah, right. Sorry. Don't even bother. It's True Blood. It's in my head.
Yeah.
Because I've been watching like four seasons of it, and then I switched to Twilight. But the larger strains of the story embellish that first chapter. And I think that when you only have that first chapter, I think it's easy to assess.
Well, I had the other chapters, and I do feel like it still carries out that way. When Edward, in the second one, when Edward leaves, how does she react? This guy who she completely validates her existence on leaves, and she falls into like this months-long depression. She's sitting in her room. They have that passage of time.
Yeah, right, I know. Just,
and you see months going by where she doesn't function. She doesn't function. She doesn't call her friends. She doesn't do any of those things. And she falls into like this real deep depression about this guy, you know, when the asshole boyfriend leaves. And I couldn't help again but thinking like, great. Now, the way you're supposed to behave.
No, you're reading it the wrong way. This is a story that teenage girls can relate to, or that young lovers can relate to. It's something that, look at how tortured she is. I feel tortured too. I can relate to those emotions, and I can see this story. And then they keep reading, and there's later some validation for it.
Yeah, he comes back, and she's like, okay, good.
Not really. He doesn't really come back. She forces the hand, so to speak, and saves his life.
She starts behaving self-destructively until he's forced to come back.
Well, there is that.
Which is, again, like, well, not until you start putting yourself at physical risk will I sweep in to stop things.
Well, I think she, yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
He
like,
sweep in to stop things, though.
Well, he started appearing to her.
Yeah, but in the book, that's actually not, and that's a problem it's a problem with the translation a little bit, but a lot of those appearances of Edward are in her head,
right?
Yeah.
You know,
right.
They're not really actually happening. So, you know, it's my thing is like, as a young man who was raised by a single mom for a large portion of his life, I think I have a lot more female like influence in me than maybe a lot of guys do. So for me, looking at this story, it brings me back to a little bit of the confused emotions of my later adolescence and even my early 20s. And it's something that I look at and go, geez, I remember feeling like these. Like that every single decision that I made regarding a girl was going to be the single most important decision I ever made in my entire life.
Sure.
And then to watch a story where it actually is the most important decision she'll ever make in her entire life, where there are all these huge repercussions and variables and all of these things
But the main difference here is that you think back to when you were a young man.
I know, and I'm...
And you were a young man.
Right, exactly.
And here we have this young girl whose existence is totally predicated on these two...
I just don't think
two,
it's that way.
Like, creepy guys, no. Basically. Like, two creepy guys.
But even so, Jason, what you're saying, I agree with it.
When we had James Dean, and he was, like, the big thing. You guys sound like parents from the 1960s who wouldn't let their teenage girls go out and watch a James Dean movie about drag racing or something like that. I mean,
no,
there's always this rebel aspect of things that girls are always going to be drawn to.
Sure.
Why do girls always like assholes? Why do girls always go for this thing?
That's not something we should be reinforcing through
these. Assholes here. They're actually very much in love with this girl. They have dark sides. They're edgy. They're whatever.
No,
I
never believe the love thing.
And the other thing too, though, is that like, you just got done saying that when you were a kid, every decision you made about a girl was the most important decision you'd ever make.
Yep.
And I agree with you. I went through it myself.
Yep.
You know, I had my heart broken in high school and I thought it would never get better. And so I understand where people identify this. What you said next was, this literally is the most important decision. This film is telling the target audience, who are people making these decisions, that yes, these decisions are the most important decisions.
No, it isn't. It's for her. It's the most important decision. It puts it in a context that's different from their own.
Yeah, but as we talked about at
the
beginning,
they can relate and they can understand those emotions and be interested in them. But they don't. They go, wow, you know, she's got it rough. That's a lot worse than what I had. It's different. You know what I mean? It's a different way to read it. But maybe you're not giving teenage girls enough credit.
You don't think there's a certain level of like,
that are,
oh my god, I'm so much like this character, and you start like,
no, I think it's that they're gonna familiarize themselves with the emotions, and they're gonna put themselves in here, but that they're not going to just blindly follow. They're not going to accept what Bella does as what's going on in their lives. They're going to relate. They're going to go, oh, that's interesting. That's that's an emotion I can actually feel and that I actually understand. But damn, that girl's got a hell of a lot worse than I do, because she's going to give up eternal life or whatever else. And I think that there's a lot more weight and heaviness to the decisions that Bella makes. And that's
yes.
part of why.
But we can
read
see that
stories.
As adults looking from the outside.
I don't think
17-year-old girls are looking at this as an instructive manual. I think they're still looking at it as escapism.
Yes.
I have shit that I'm going through.
To.
Exactly.
It's
I have shit I'm going
titanium.
Through. Yeah, it's yeah. I have shit I'm going through. This is like the shit I'm going through, but it's on a completely different stage and I can watch it acted out and that doesn't have to instruct what I do.
And I'm going
to
go one step forward. You don't have to be a teenage girl to see it. You could be a 36-year-old guy. You could be a 40-year-old woman. You could be whoever. And you would still be able to look at it as this stuff is playing out on a stage. I can relate to a lot of that love, a lot of that romance, a lot of that stuff. And you can look at it. I totally don't think that I don't see what you guys are talking about because I do. Creepy as fuck, a lot of it, sure. But I just choose to view it in a different
way. But a lot of that creepiness, if you're going to write off the creepiness from this movie, you have to write off every vampire movie since Stoker. You really
do.
The themes are all fucking there in every single one.
The themes are always there, but they're always...
They're not geared to the audience of the young?
No. In other movies, the vampire is always portrayed as an other. And
who, in some capacity, is preying on the object
right.
of his affection.
And in the case of Twilight, Edward and the Cullens are not others. They are not outsiders in the way that other vampires are. They're mainstreaming. They've come out of the coffin,
yeah.
And they're trying to integrate into society. Mm-hmm. And that sense of danger is not there. Mm-hmm. It's not. The choice is not really made clear that if you become a vampire, you are forsaking your humanity and forsaking the things that, your soul, that which makes you essentially human.
Jacob personifies that whole argument later on.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he does. Yeah. That's his reason for being in this whole story is that he personifies that I'm going to save your soul.
Right. His argument is if you stay with me, we can have that love, but I'll grow old with you. And he doesn't have those mortality.
Yeah, you don't have to give up anything.
But he is incredibly aggressive and still has that weird dark side. Right. So
there's that tent scene. There's the tent scene up on the mountain in the third one where there's this whole scene where, one of the angry vampires is hunting Bella or whatever, and they're trying to get rid of these vampires and this whole big battle thing happens. And they try to get Bella away. So they have Jacob take her away, and she's there with Edward in the tent, and it starts to get cold at night, and she starts to basically freeze to death.
Yeah.
And Edward can't do shit about it because he's even colder than it is outside.
And then Jacob
has
to
come in. Yeah. And so there's this weird – there's some sexuality going on there. There's all kinds of shit going on there. But it does – I don't necessarily agree with the way – that Stephanie Meyer gets across some of those points. I don't think it's as good as it could have been. I definitely think that not only Hardwick, I think every director that's taken this on, because Chris Weitz did the second one, and did he do the third one as well?
David Slade did the third one.
He did the best job. But there were definitely some decisions made in that aspect of things that I think part of the problem is that it doesn't earn what it's trying to do, and that's why it comes across that way to you, because it doesn't earn the love. It doesn't earn the creepiness. None of that is there. But that is, I think, in a lot of ways, it's because of direction, but a lot of ways it's the source material.
That is, I think, one of the biggest failures of all three of these films. And I touched on it at the beginning. I couldn't even fall in interest with this character. Mm-hmm. At no point did I understand the whole time where I was like, why does anybody care enough about this girl
themselves in the role of Bella. And they're thinking.
No, I mean, why do the other characters care? Why does Edward care so much about her? I'm sure in the book it's there.
Because she smells good.
I'm sure in the book it's
her
there.
Her blood smells good. Which is, it was the most insane thing. I in a movie full of insane things, I was like, that's it? Like, he's attracted to the smell of her blood? And then gets to know her as a person?
Yeah.
Well, presumably?
One thing
well,
we've
he's
been...
attracted to her... It's
well, let's not act like that's not how it happens with
you
us.
To the woman that you really love. What is that? What is that fundamental thing?
Right.
We can't always put a pin. We can't always say. But maybe there was one thing.
Yeah.
That
she looks really smart.
Knockers, right?
Yeah.
I like that Nick walks over. The guy that's recording this show just walked over and held his hands in front of his chest.
Huge tracts of land.
He's calling in.
But I mean, like, no. In all seriousness, I mean, like, what is it? For him, because he's a vampire, he was drawn to this scent to the point where he was repelled by it because he couldn't feed. And he was like, you know,
right.
sit by.
But I mean, one of the problems I had with the fact that Edward is, you know, chronologically 100 and some odd sure. years old.
109.
100. Thank you.
I
tried to do the math. I think, yeah, he was like 108 or something.
Carry the one.
Carry
no
the one. You know, divide by pi, whatever. But he's chronologically 109-year-old guy, and he's way into this 17-year-old. And I was
he's
thinking,
109-year-old guy that's been living in a family as a 17-year-old for 100 years.
I think the age that they present to the public is an act.
Yes.
Which I never understood.
And maybe this is a fundamentally different.
It is to some degree, but let me just stick with this point here. In the grand tradition of what we're saying, that what we are presuming that the target audience is doing in Twilight, I put myself in Edward's shoes for a moment, and I thought, if I was 108 years old, would I want to hang out with a 17-year-old girl? And my immediate answer was no.
But Bella isn't a typical 17-year-old girl.
But also,
there's something different.
You're
about
forgetting.
Her.
You're
She's drawn.
There's
the
something, but there's
like,
something completely forgotten.
No, you keep saying, but Arizona. You know, she comes from Arizona, but she's got pale skin. She's got the ability that her mind isn't red. Now, think about that. Think about Suki Stackhouse from True Blood, all right? Why is she drawn to Bill? One of the primary reasons is because she can't read his thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Edward can read everybody's thoughts, but he can't read hers. Yeah, boner. You know, you're 100 years old, and you're like, all right.
But she's 17 years
old. But there's something
like
you're forgetting. You guys are all missing. You're missing a huge point. He's not 109 as in he's lived 109 years.
Yes, he has.
His life stopped at 17 as well.
Whoa.
Hold on. His life stopped at 17. He has not had real life experiences since then. He's been locked up with the Cullens, not really having the normal life.
I feel
so
like this is pretty much the way his life has been.
You
it's
can't.
Much the life that's presented.
It's not like he's had the normal experiences that changes a 17-year-old into a 25-year-old. He's missing most of that.
He keeps going to high schools and matriculating.
He's missed all of those experiences, so he's not really.
But
it's
even,
not like he's going out and going and like experiencing life and doing. All
it's not
things.
Time
right,
that
okay.
makes you different. It's the experiences, and he's not had them. His life has been shut off.
I agree.
At that point.
If we were to believe what's presented to us in the movie, though, there's this wall, this framed picture of you know, graduation caps. So obviously Edward has been to high school multiple times.
Yep.
And as we see in the movie, those dudes are going on field trips. They're going to the greenhouse and learning about compost.
But if all you ever
and
experienced
and
was high school,
how much they did it in other instances.
And if all you ever experienced was high school, how would you be anything other than a high school student?
I was in high school for 100 times. I would get better at it by the end.
Well, right. Yeah, you would get better at high school, but you would still be
okay,
high school.
Maybe I'm not 17 anymore.
And not
but
only
could
that,
we agree
you're
like 25?
I think you guys are really missing a larger point, which is...
It's semantics that we're arguing.
No, we're not arguing semantics at all, because we're arguing a key point of this story, that he was pulled out of his existence to some extent by this girl. That there's something about her that stopped him from doing the same thing that he's done all the time. That he's actually... a switch flipped in him, and that this destined pairing had to happen.
See, I
and you're that's the story there,
John.
Yeah.
Do you think the seriousness that we have taken with Twilight may sink our podcast?
Yes. and I was worried about this when I actually said to Larry,
uh-oh,
I said, "This is the Halloween episode, but all we're going to talk about is love."
Well, here's something. Here's an interesting track that we've been
Valentine's Day podcast.
But here's an interesting track that we've been avoiding, and we've been, you know, we can keep having, but no, we can keep having the circular argument about all this stuff. But there is something that we keep half bringing up and then walking away from is the technical problems with this movie. This movie, regardless of original source material, all of these directors are fucking shit.
Can I ask a question?
All of them.
Can I ask a question? Now, when you're going to I understand the way these vampires were supposed to look.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I see the Cullens in that high school, if you saw a kid walk into your classroom that looked that way, wouldn't you fucking call the nurse immediately? Like, there's a corpse, and I would start looking for the outbreak monkey. Like, there are really sick people here. That's not a person. That guy is really unhealthy.
That might be a willing suspension of disbelief.
Yes,
item,
I know.
That you
yeah. My issue more with that was, although Edward looks as though he, you know, he is 17, the other members of the Cullen family look like they're 30 to 35 years old. There's that one older brother who looks like a mini Leaf Schreiber.
Yeah.
And they walk into the high school, and I'm like, they need to check in with the office because they've obviously already graduated.
I had the same feeling.
I was willing to suspend my disbelief of the pale skin. I was like, all right, it's Northwestern Washington.
I'm 40.
Like, but these people like look 40. It's not, not even in the way in the 80s in horror movies where all the teenagers look like they were 35.
Because at least they all did.
Right. Yeah.
Because everyone did. And you were like, okay. But clearly you have some 17-year-old in this high school, and then you have like five people who are over the age of 30 walking around attending classes, and everyone's cool with it. They're like, oh, that's the Cullens.
Yeah, right. They're fucking weird.
It's like, I mean, do they have the Benjamin Button disease? Are they aging backwards?
What's really weird about them is they walk in slow motion.
I know that our school systems are broken, but I'd like to think we can get kids out of there before 30.
Actually, we just brought in a bunch of grad students to raise our test scores. It's totally cool.
They all play for the football team or the, you know, the vampire baseball team.
Yes.
Okay, can
we talk about vampire baseball?
Right. Vampire baseball makes Quidditch look like Brazilian cage fighting. I have never seen anything more embarrassingly sissy than vampire baseball.
No, it's even what's even stupider than vampire baseball is that Hardwick didn't have the imagination to actually get people that could have actually played baseball.
Yeah.
So it looks fucking ridiculous, number one. Number two, the whole concept, right off the fucking page, is idiotic.
Those are those little baseball touch
so that we can hit the ball when the thunder goes off and no one will notice. Like I had to, after watching.
Never mind that they won't notice that there are vampires running 90 miles an hour in the field over there.
I had so much. And what's funny is it took them like a country, like it felt like it took like an hour around the bases.
I know.
Down the ball in the woods, whatever else. But I mean, like, honestly, it is the stupidest part of the vampire baseball. I could ride with it for most of it.
Uh-huh.
They all dressed as like 1930s baseball.
Right. Yeah, they really did. And,
like old Honus Wagner.
Yeah. I'm so infuriated.
Now
by
batting, Edward Cullen.
I will ride to the ends of the earth to find myself a good love story, but don't put vampires in fucking bin strikes.
After I watched the movie, I checked in with Carrie and I was like trying to explain this. I was like, there's the scene. I said, I had forgotten about it the first time I saw it, and now watching it again, like, they play baseball. And that doesn't happen in the book, does it? Like, nobody would write a vampire baseball scene. And she's like, yeah, actually.
But my mind was blown.
I was like, all right, do whatever you want to the vampire mythology. But baseball?
Yeah.
Like, that's what you come up with?
Can we?
I had a list, guys, of clever versus not so clever.
I don't want to totally kill you guys with this.
I thought that there were things that were clever. Vampires don't need sleep because they're dead. Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm fine with that. I love the ice parallels. I liked them, including even Sparkle Motion. I thought it was okay. Superhero versus vampire parallels. Thought they were kind of interesting, and they were called up in the dialogue, which I thought was really good. I love the exchange. He says, what do you think I am? She says, I've considered radioactive spiders and kryptonite.
Uh-huh.
And then he says, what if I'm not the hero? What if I'm the bad guy? Love it.
Right. No,
great.
I agree. I thought those like superpowers helped individualize them. Yeah. And I thought that was kind of
the
neat
jokes
touch
about the endless high school graduations. I like that a lot. The idea of building a vampire family so that you don't, you know, see people die and everything else. I like that. Extra powers possessed by vampires at first, it seemed way too plot convenient, but then I started thinking about it, and it's an impetus to create vampires, and it allows this whole other Bella story.
When you're putting together your A-team, you need to figure out,
whether these people are actually
We need somebody that can play first base.
But I also think, you're right, it does help individualize people.
We need a good designated hitter.
And if you're going to have more than one key vampire in the story, you need a distinguishing characteristic between them, and so it's necessary.
Like, I forgot about that vampire Jasper. The one who always looked like he was gonna throw up.
He's gonna like
at any,
yeah.
He looks at like any moment.
And they actually say that.
In the script, one of the teenage
kids says it about him.
Yeah. I like trying to keep track of the Cullens. I was like, well, there's the dad who's inexplicably the town surgeon, and then the mom, and then Edward, that sister who's kind of pouty, the other sister who's like the goth mind reader.
Right.
The one dude who looks like Liev Schreiber. That's all I could think of him as.
That's
Rosalie's
guy.
And I was like, there's that other one. He's like the red shirt of the Cullens. Like,
no, he actually ends up being really important later on.
Yeah.
And he has an excellent character where you get backstory out of him, which is really cool. But anyway, let me just get to not so clever. Not so clever.
Vegetarian vampires.
I'll say, you know, I didn't mind that, but fair enough. choosing
not
to live
budging
in,
on that
choosing
one.
To live in Washington so that they can day walk, I thought was silly. The vampires playing baseball, absolutely idiotic. That we never saw the Cullens eat, I think, is a huge missed opportunity to show them as the what they really are. No fangs.
Yeah.
WTF. No, and I think, did I hear that the word fangs doesn't appear in the book either? No. There are some things that, like, it turns out are never written into the book. The word fangs never showed up.
I don't know that there are any fangs, but...
I may have completely made that up.
I think the most obvious is Twilight as a title for a bunch of vampires that can walk around during the day.
Yeah. Right. The whole moon cycle thing doesn't...
I like the moon. I like the moon stuff because it speaks more to Jacob.
Yeah, but that's the problem. You know, is he supposed to be an opposing character? He's not supposed to be.
Yeah, I suppose.
You know what I mean? Well, so
why don't we go ahead and take a quick break, and we'll come back in just a second.
And do what you like, because I found a body to call my home. And dozens of roses left by the phone.
So, in a lot of ways, with all this crazy vampire-ness going on, and we keep talking about all the conflict of youth, in a lot of ways, this is kind of a high school movie.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that jumped out at me in one of those early scenes was the kids hanging out outside their high school shooting the shit reminded me a lot of the early scenes in Scream of the kids doing the same thing. And Kristen Stewart and Neve Campbell kind of jumped out at me as being sort of parallel at those points in their career, and they have a very similar sort of withdrawn, stuttery kind of acting style. That kind of stuff jumped out at me, and I thought, in a lot of ways, this is a high school movie at its core.
Yeah.
Well, I definitely agree with you, Mike. I think that when I watched this movie, I felt that it was a really good... I don't know how great a representation it is of high school life, but I know one thing. They definitely went the John Hughes route of picking all the really great music from a specific time.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know that Stephanie Meyer is a huge Muse fan, which I'm sure they don't count high amongst their fan base.
Right.
Probably like, oh, good. Her and Glenn Beck, terrific. You know, I think the soundtracks to these movies, and the music doesn't always work. That's the other thing. And that's, again, I just blame the directors because I think they just made a lot of really bad choices. But the music itself is quite good all the way through, and it really reminded me a lot of those John Hughes movies. And I think that they do, you know, speak a lot to the emotions and feelings and confusion of being a teenager, specifically with Bella, not so much her friends who just seem sort of there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I would like to say that I've talked a lot of shit about Twilight in this episode. To our listeners, it may sound like that I thought that this movie had no redeeming qualities, but I would like to say that it has one redeeming quality, and that's the end credits, when they replay key scenes from the movie in black and white. And they play this pretty good Radiohead song over it.
Yeah, they do.
This was the only moment in all 2 hours of Twilight that I was totally on board with it. And I wish that I could perhaps have watched Twilight in music video form, because I feel like it is a movie and subject matter ideally suited to a 2.5 minute, 3 minute music video with a really awesome, you know, pop song or indie rock song or something. Then I could say I am a Twilight fan and perhaps, you know, get some of these, you know, I think what Jason was saying before, like all of these teenage emotions and everything are perfectly encapsulated in pop music and music videos.
Oh, you could
when
agree
you,
more.
When you try to stretch them out over 2 hours, I think then you have, you know,
ample opportunity.
The great boxing glove of hubris will come and knock you in the mouth.
Maybe in a music video, you would cut out vampire baseball, right? Like you wouldn't have that in the video, right?
Maybe you have it, but it's only 15 seconds long, so it's not nearly as offensive.
It's not
which
nearly
is 14
egregious.
Seconds longer than vampire baseball is interesting.
I think you only have vampire baseball if it's a Mellencamp song.
Well, I think that Larry makes a terrific point. I think Larry's overall point here is that it's something that I thought about. I hear a lot that people talk about Twilight as the Twilight saga. Okay. And that sort of pisses me off. All right. Star Wars is a saga. Lord of the Rings is a saga.
Harry Potter
the Dark
is a
Tower
saga.
Is a saga. Harry Potter is a saga.
Police Academy.
Police Academy.
May possibly be a saga because it's seven... fucking movies.
I mean,
alone,
they get to Moscow.
They do. So therein lies
and
the
Miami,
you know,
Beach. So.
But I think that terming Twilight as a saga is that hubris. And I think you're right. I think a lot of what goes on in these movies could have been summed up in a friggin' music video.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think you nailed it. But in a music video, would we have been treated to the awesomeness of Billy Burke as Charlie?
Thank you.
Standout in a cast full of poor acting.
I don't think that the cast is filled with poor acting. I don't. But we'll
come back to that point. But here, Jason and I have been in opposite camps about our interpretations of Twilight. But I think we have found an accord here, and that Billy Burke is the best actor mm-hmm. in this movie. And his character, even though he is not on screen that often, yeah. is the best character.
He's so well fleshed out. He's mm-hmm. and that was something that when I was thinking about those John Hughes movies, I was like, but it's not a John Hughes movie because the parents exist.
Yeah.
Right.
And I really like the fact that the parents exist mm-hmm. in this movie. And I think if we did a music video version, the parents wouldn't exist.
No, the parents wouldn't.
So I would miss Billy Burke, and I would miss Nina from 24 as her mother. You know, like, and I don't know what her name is. Yeah. I don't know what that actress's name is. But Sherry was the one that picked it out. She's like, wow, that's Nina from 24. Yeah. Like,
I didn't recognize her.
No fucking way.
I recognized it and immediately was like, don't trust her, Bella.
She's totally going to kill your wife. Wait.
She's a bad guy.
What?
Bella, when she tells you to go into the computer room, don't.
No. Yeah.
But Billy Burke
we
is
just
the most.
24. I didn't think that was going to happen.
Well played.
Charlie's the most real, like, real world character of all of them. I think in some ways, because you've got some archetypes going on, because you've got some idyllic versions of people going on, Charlie's the only one that feels like a real single dad.
Well, I think that.
Stuck with this obnoxious fucking kitty cat.
She's annoying, but I find her real. Like, that's the thing. Like, I find Bella as real. I just do. I don't know why I do. But
I only think she's real if you imprint a real person on her, though.
Perhaps. Maybe.
And I think that's the problem. Yeah, but Billy Burke, I think, stands on his own as a character. And he's the dad next door.
Yeah. Oh, I love the fact that he just didn't know how to react around his daughter.
Yeah.
And that, in some ways, I feel as though she embodies a lot of his sort of uneasiness with, you know, she's very uneasy with herself.
Yeah.
She's very sort of whatever. He has that same kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know, going. But he's an adult, and they never really know how to integrate the two of them, and I love that relationship.
They're always kind of dancing around each
other. They
are,
you know.
Yeah.
But there was a great moment in, I think it was the third movie, where he actually, like, puts his arm around his daughter and kind of, like, brings her a little bit close. It was an absent sort of moment. He was looking at a computer screen and talking to her, but he kind of brings her close. And she seemed, like, so uncomfortable by it, but at the same time sort of played this nice comfort. It was weird. I know I just said uncomfortable but played comfort, but that's the way she balances a lot of conflicting emotions all the time. And it gets annoying, and I think, again, I just go back to your assessment of her acting style was spot on.
Oh.
You know, absolutely spot on. She does do that. But Billy Burke, absolutely, all agree.
Billy Burke is a legitimate actor.
Stands out.
He stands out, and he, you know, does a lot of communicating with, you know, facial expressions, mm-hmm. body posture. Mm-hmm. That scene in the first movie where Kristen Stewart runs off to Arizona and she's got to, like, make up some story, and she looks at him and she's like, I don't want to be stuck here.
Oh,
you know, and it's like this devastating line, and she does all right delivering it. But
I was so mad at her.
But looking at, you know, Billy Burke, she, like, runs out the door and he just stands there.
Yeah, he's crushed.
And you can tell that, like, he's not, like, reacting outwardly, mm-hmm. but you can just tell by the way he's standing that he's like
really truly living.
She just like dropped a bomb on
him.
This is what I have to look forward to.
And what's amazing what's amazing to me is that Bella's character knows what she just did and says it in the car, but then doesn't really cry, and that infuriated me.
Yeah, right.
When I was watching this.
Right.
I mean, I know I come off as a bit of a Twilight apologist in this group anyway, but don't get me wrong, guys. I don't find this, you know, as infallible. So, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think that's when you're looking at this movie from a technical sort of standpoint, that's you know, that's one of the things that brings it into sharp contrast is you have Billy Burke, who is a great actor, and mm-hmm. he's taking this character who I don't know how he's portrayed in the books or anything, but really like investing the character, you know, with a real personality and real emotion, and you know, delivering the few lines he has with something behind them,
yeah.
Because he's good, and you can give him like poor source material or a poor script, and he'll come up with something good. Whereas Kristen Stewart, you're giving her this devastating line, you're expecting this reaction from her. Mm-hmm. That, as you know, thinking of her just as an actress, like you would think she would come out with this, even yeah. if it's not on the page, and she doesn't.
That's not Kristen Stewart's fault. She was perfectly capable of pulling that off. That's Catherine Hardwicke.
Yeah.
When I look at films as the responsibility of the mm-hmm. director. It is not the responsibility. And that's why I find things like the Oscars sort of silly in a lot of ways.
Right.
Because to me, the director, the editor, those folks pull those performances together. Yeah, mm-hmm. the actor has to get there. And certainly Billy Burke is a very talented mm-hmm. actor. So Hardwicke couldn't fuck it up.
The director is responsible for what gets on the screen.
You're yeah. absolutely yeah. right.
It doesn't matter how yeah. many takes and you have to do it. You get it out of your actors.
You're absolutely yep. right. And she was lazy and she let that shit fly. Mm-hmm. And that's why. And I do feel as though Stewart does a better job in the following two movies.
Yeah.
Specifically the David, I think his name's David Slade, the guy that did the third movie, Eclipse, I'm assuming yep. is the third movie. You know, that movie I felt was far better directed. There were better performances and everything else, which is weird because the cinematography wasn't quite as good.
Right.
Which is weird. Yeah. It was a little
yeah,
too
there were some things, like, and I really didn't like what Catherine Hardwicke did with a lot of things. I did think in the first one, from a pure technical aspect,
yeah.
I thought there was a certain economy to what she was doing with the camera that I kind of liked.
Yeah.
There were some things that I thought, oh, that's really efficient filmmaking, like yeah. There weren't too many bells and whistles no. in a movie where you could have a lot of yeah. bells and whistles.
Well,
let me tell you where things start getting out of control, and this isn't just her, and it isn't just this movie. Jacob. Now, first, I will say, and this might have surprised a few people, it turns out I am Team Jacob.
I am too.
I actually, going through these three movies,
if I also had to select a team, which I do not want to select a team, but if I had to, I would also be Team Jacob.
Thank God, because we already had like some pretty severe Team Edward pedophile, not pedophile, turf wars going on here. So that could have got ugly. But and I'm surprised to say, I actually found myself kind of liking Taylor Lautner.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, this kid's actually not that bad.
It's a good character.
Like, hurt to say, because I was so ready to be like, fuck this guy. But, and this is almost unforgivable in a movie that is almost as much about werewolves as vampires or a saga.
Certainly,
anyway.
Absolutely.
Those CGI wolves were fucking terrible.
In the second movie, in the third movie, they weren't.
They were.
In the third movie, they were far better.
They were better in the third movie, but the effects didn't get any necessarily any better in other areas. That whole scene of him picking her up and running was fucking laughable.
It was better in the third. I think they got much better as the series went on.
But in the third movie, he picks her up right before the tent scene. He picks her up to run into the woods.
Yeah.
And that scene right there, when you're panned way out, and it's clearly a CG Jacob moving with Bella in arm, is fucking like literally. I was with a hardcore Twilight fan sitting next to me who laughed out loud at how fucking the effects in these movies, with a few exceptions, are horrendous.
And I don't know if this whole thing, maybe this is me too fresh off the heels of the Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which really impressed the shit out of me in terms of like rendering a digital
motion
character.
Motion capture, yeah.
I mean,
Andy
like,
Serkis,
really,
yet again.
Yeah, like really just blew my doors right off. And so maybe I was too fresh out of that experience, but I just like, I couldn't believe that it passed as acceptable for those to be the wolves that you get in this movie. It just pulled me so far out of what was already kind of a silly movie. I was like, unbelievable.
Well, how about Van Helsing? I mean,
that was the whole movie the whole time.
Fair enough, right?
There's always this weird, I don't know, it's not quite a disconnect. It's like weird choices that studios make mm-hmm. for these like big budget movies. Like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, that was a Fox movie, wasn't it, I think? Or whoever yeah. did it, they were, you know, obviously Rise of the Planet of the Apes is not going to be the universal blockbuster that Twilight is. It's not gonna bring in all this cash. But they at least said, all right, well, if we're gonna make this monkey movie, we're gonna hire Peter Jackson's Weta Workshop mm-hmm. to do the effects, like a bunch of guys who like know how to do CGI really well.
They're going to get it right.
They're going to get it right. And for movies like Twilight or, you know, like Green Lantern this summer, like these are like major, like huge tentpole movies that these studios know that millions of people are going to come to. And they're like, well, fuck it. We're just going to, you know, we could spend $100 million on CGI and make it look really good, but we'll just spend $50 million and make
they
it look kind of like...
They don't care because it doesn't matter.
The profit's a foregone conclusion.
Exactly. Right. When the profit is a foregone conclusion, I don't think that the artistry really holds up.
Now, let me ask you again, can we blame... And I know it's tough because, you know, you're talking gravitas. Can we blame the director for not standing up to the studio and demanding... demanding
no,
that they
that's more of a producer's loss there.
Yeah.
You know, I think that with the second movie and with the werewolves and the rendering of those and everything else, I think it was just they did the best they could with what they had. You know what I mean? I don't think that that – each movie, I think, went up in budget. Catherine Hardwick's movie, I know, had a very, very small budget, as I recall. It was not – they didn't want it – they didn't know how it was going to translate. They didn't know it was going to be a huge success. They figured it would, but they didn't know. So they didn't spend that much. And it kind of shows. I mean, it's, it's a cheaper flick. Yeah. The effects in the first movie are pretty rotten. Him running up trees and running around. It looks ridiculous.
That stuff was driving me bananas.
But I don't mind because, I mean, if we're going to talk about vampire movies, I mean, come on. Vampire movies in general, more often than not, are fucking silly.
We'll talk about Hammer, I'm sure.
Fair enough. Yeah. Although I will. We will talk about Hammer. When we get to Hammer...
Yeah,
I want to talk about some excellent effects.
Yeah, they're good and bad
but I mean,
examples.
Like seriously, if we're going to take vampire, you know, it got better in the second movie a little bit, but it also they had to do these CG wolves, and those wolves did not work. Mm. So they addressed it in the third movie. The third movie, I noticed, I did very little research to prepare, but the one thing I did notice was that it cost $68 million to make,
and it was the first time I think they got a director who had some
experience
and success. This is the same guy who did Hard Candy
and 30 Days of Night.
This
Which
is a guy
is
who
a
had.
Fucking spectacular vampire movie.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who had translated to the screen a couple of times very, very well, both with a character-driven drama like Hard Candy is.
Right.
Like, holy shit, character. And then with 30 Days a Night, which is a very effects-heavy movie.
So that's Slade?
That's David Slade.
Wow.
So
I like that guy. I really do.
Yeah,
I think
the third one, I think what you see there is it's very easy to pick out. The problems with the third one, I think, are more easily blamed on the source material.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Whereas with Hardwick, it's hard to tell because it's not great source material and she sucks.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I think you're right on about that. And I think
Happy Halloween, Kevin Hardwick.
And that you suck. You suck so much that when she was kind of interested in coming back for the second movie and then they weren't going to pay her enough money or they weren't going to give her enough of a budget, one of the two.
Yeah.
And I was like, thank God the studio kind of stood up because she really didn't do a very good job, you know?
I think they
Catherine Hardwick, you may submit your emails to Mike and John at Film Jitsu. Well, whatever. Don't send us any emails.
Send us a poorly crafted email.
I think the interesting thing is we came into this trying to figure out what would be a good movie to do for a roundtable because of the success of last year's. I think that the talking about the remake of Halloween gave us a lot of material to work with, and we were a little afraid that we wouldn't necessarily have that much if we didn't pick the right film. And it turns out...
It turns out a bunch of dudes over the age of 30 have a lot to say about Twilight.
The good news is this podcast was probably never going to get us laid. Now this podcast is definitely never going to get us laid.
Might not get you laid. It's definitely going to get me laid. I'm the sensitive one.
And in fact, it might open up a couple of files of investigation. Maybe the authorities are going to look a little bit deeper into some of us. I don't want to say that Jason said a couple times, she's 17, sure, but she's hot. Suspect phrasing.
Oh, no.
Sure.
Oh, God. I don't think I said that.
What's a better ass, Walter?
Shut the fuck up, Donnie.
Seriously.
So, but I definitely want to thank you guys for coming along, and we're going to wrap up this first half here of the review of Twilight, and you know, I want to thank the listeners for sticking with us. I know this is a little bit longer than our normal episode, and it's one full, you know, review rather than the segments that we normally do. So I want to thank the listeners for that, and hope everybody comes back for the next half of this.
Oh, we really hope so.
The listener, we'd like to thank the one person who hung through a, like, deep down, balls out, serious discussion of Twilight. The one person.
But
your balls out?
You didn't see them twinkling in the sun?
Oh. I thought it was a disco ball. I was confused.
So please come back.
Icy hot finger cup.
Icy hot. So please come back for the second half, where we will be discussing our top five vampires, which I'm sure will be as spirited a discussion as the Twilight discussion has been. So thank you very much to the listeners. Хочу зазвикати, я бачу сати,
сати, карати, карати, я бачу так задні вікя і застаний зад. I agree with the point that you were making that
It was a really good point, apparently.